So I think we ought to begin. The question has been raised by a number of people for Larry. And so as the answer to this question, which Larry will tell you in a moment, is something that a number of people wanted to discuss, it seemed reasonable, and I hope you all agree with this, that Larry should continue his talk. Because, unfortunately, time ran out at a crucial point. And so we're going to ask Larry if he would come back again and give the rest of his talk, and that then he can, or perhaps even weave in, who knows, the answer to these fundamental questions which he's been asked. Larry.
Well, thank you. I feel like the bad penny. You know, I keep coming back. You thought you were going to get rid of me, but here we go again. One question that has surfaced in informal conversation with you is this. You know, you've talked about two kinds of evidence for healing. One is these radical miracle-type studies that just leave you speechless about their degree. And then there's these healing research studies which show small effects in animals and in human studies. And why, when we put prayer and healing and intentionality to the test in these experiments, why don't we see something sensational there? And we don't. And I think that's a really good question. I just want to say something about the status of this healing research and what it looks like to me. And not a lot of people share these opinions, but there you are. I think that it's only fair to say that this healing research that I've talked about in these controlled studies, randomized, controlled double-blind study type things, really is in its infancy. Robert Wyman, who's at Yale University, who said this about meditation research, could say it equally about this prayer research that I've talked about. This research is a first pass on a new topic, and you just can't do perfect science the first time through. You get curious about something and you mess around. That's what science is in the beginning. You mess around. So we're sort of messing around with how to do these healing research studies. So, again, why don't we see something sensational like these spontaneous miracle-type happenings in the studies? I think the reason mainly is, there are several reasons, but I just want to focus on one. It has to do with what we call ecological validity. And ecological validity is a term which means something simple. If you are going to test something that occurs in the real world in the laboratory, you ought to test it in the laboratory the way it's used in the real world. Otherwise, you're violating ecological validity. Now, you know, this is one of those duh things. I mean, it just makes common sense that you would do that, but we don't. And what happens is that prayer, just to take an example of one form of intentionality, is never used in these studies like it's used in real life. For example, we say in real life that we pray for our loved ones, right? Well, that doesn't happen in these studies. The subjects aren't loved ones with respect to the people who are doing the praying. They don't even know them. What happens in the studies is that strangers are praying for strangers. And also, people in the studies do not know whether or not they're being prayed for. Nowhere in the world is prayer used in real life the way it's used in these studies. It would be like if your mother were having coronary bypass surgery tomorrow, and you go to her bedside in the hospital tonight and you say, "Well, Mom, you know, I know you're having this life-threatening operation tomorrow, but I just really haven't decided if I'm going to pray for you or not." I don't know your mother, but I don't think you would do that. But that's what we do in these prayer studies. So this is what I mean by violating ecological validity. Stephen Broad, philosopher and a hotshot consciousness researcher, says, "It's almost comically arrogant to think that nature would conform to our favorite modes of investigation, or that we should dictate to nature the forms in which we're willing to accept her secrets." But that's the position we get into in these studies. And the problem is, it's summarized by Einstein, everything that counts cannot be counted, and everything that counts. What did I do here? That Einstein, he's a clever guy. Everything that counts cannot be counted, and everything that can be counted does not count. And it's hard to count what is important, and the studies such as, how do you assess or calibrate the degree of empathy or compassion in somebody praying in these studies when there's no instrument to do so? I mean, we don't have any instruments to measure empathy and compassion, but we know in real life that those things are crucial. And so the limitations of these studies, I think, point to the fact that we should pay much more attention to these spontaneous or miracle so-called cases. A question that has come up, I forgot how many times in the hall, I've had this conversation with some of you, is there a dark side to the collective unitary non-local mind? In other words, are hexes, curses, and spells real via the avenue of collective consciousness? In other words, does the bad stuff get around? I actually think this is an important issue, and I wrote a book about it once. It's called Be Careful What You Pray For, and it was an exploration of the role of hexes, curses, spells, and negative prayer in real life. This book was the most sensational flop I ever had as a book, because nobody, well, I can't say everybody, but almost no one in the States wants to even get close to this concept. You ought to see some of the steaming letters I got. You know, my God would never answer a negative prayer, that sort of thing. And that was putting it mildly. So this book, as S.J. Perelman said, went unread by millions. Well, if you look at the biblical record, you find scores of examples of hexes and curses and spells in both the Old and the New Testament. In the New Testament, Jesus cursed a perfectly innocent fruit tree because it was not blooming out of season. Doesn't seem fair to fruit trees. And he cast the demons into the herd of hogs, and then they ran off the cliff, the Gadarene instance. Those are just two examples. Those sounds like pretty potent hexes or spells. So there are any number of these sorts of things in the Bible and the Old and New Testament. Now, the good thing is that this has been recognized in Christianity for a long time. One of my favorite books about prayer is the Oxford Book of Prayer, and there's an entire section in the Oxford Book of Prayer called Prayers of Protection. So if you're feeling vulnerable, you might just kind of check it out. Barbie and I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and in northern New Mexico, there's a shaman behind every rock. And when I was doing this book on hexes and curses and spells, I had the opportunity to ask Native American shamans, do you think negative stuff is part of the intentionality thing? And I quit asking the question because they said things like, how could you not? Why do you even ask the question? Of course it is. And then I changed my inquiry, and I asked the shamans, since we all know that this stuff is out there, what do you do to protect yourself? And the most memorable answer I got was from a famous Native American healer in those parts. And he said, have you ever heard of the Lord's Prayer? And I said, yeah, I've heard of the Lord's Prayer. And he said, what about that clause, and it deliver us from evil? And I thought, where is this going? And he started pointing at me and shaking his finger. He said, you white people have one of the best prayers of protection going, and you don't even realize it. And then he patted himself on the chest, and he said, I use that one myself. So I think negative intentionality is quite real. I mean, I don't think that the one mind comes with just a positive sign with it. And I think we can be Pollyannish about this and think that when we get into the one mind state, everybody is going to live happily ever after. I do not believe that. I think there is a dark side to it. That said, I'm convinced that we are not sitting ducks, susceptible to every negative thought that comes through via the collective consciousness. I think that we can compare our immunity to hexes, curses, spells, and negative thoughts of others by comparing ourselves to what happens when we get exposed to microbes that can cause disease. Through the long evolutionary chain, we have developed an immune system to threats to our physical, corporeal existence from microbes. And I think that if these threats are real on the intentionality level, it would make sense that we would have developed psychological immune defenses in a similar way to negative thoughts from other people. I think we do have a psychological immune system that helps protect us from the thoughts, curses, negative intentions of other people via the one mind. And I think this works pretty well. And I think it works in the same way that our physical immune system does. It works at an unconscious level. We don't have to turn it on and off. And I think it serves us greatly. So I want to try to make lemonade out of lemons here and say that although the negative intentionality aspect of the one mind is very real, we have a highly efficient immune response to that. So I want to sort of leave this on a positive note and say there are two sides to the immune, to the one mind. It has a dark side, but it's not all that dark.
Professor?
Yeah, thanks very much. Well, thank you, Larry, very much indeed. That was great. I always feel terribly sorry for Lot, because Lot's wife, really, because she was never protected, was she? And she just turned around and looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, I mean, that's a really mean thing to do. And one would have hoped that she would have had her psychological protection in place, but she clearly didn't. Okay, so the format for the rest of the morning, the rest of the afternoon, is that we're going to potentially go up till 4 o'clock. It depends if you guys have got lots and lots of questions, which I hope you have, because I always feel that this is one of the most important moments of the conference when you have your speakers up here and you can ask some questions. Tom gives his apologies. He had a very important family meeting that he had to go to, so he won't be here, but I think the others are. So I'll ask the speakers to come up, but I'm also looking for a lift for Marion to London. Who is going to take Marion to London?
Marilyn, sorry.
Come on, somebody must be taking Marilyn to London.
British Rail.
What was that?
Is it, you're going in a cab? Okay, with the Dossies?
Would you be happy to go with the Dossies? Okay, and are you happy to take Marilyn? Well, that's just perfect. Okay, well, there you are. I knew we'd be able to arrange it. Okay, so can we have all the speakers here, please? We have one radio mic, and so I suggest that we ask our questions via the radio mic, if that works, which means then that you won't be catching your chairman's eyes. You'll be catching the guys who's handing the radio mic around and get him, try and persuade him to come and give it to you. So that's really nice. Nice democratic thing. So it's all on the floor, as it were. So, yeah, are you going to ask a question?
What'd she say?
She said that she thought you were putting it under the floor.
What'd she say?
She thought she was putting it on the floor. And
she wants the mic. That's okay. You can have the mic, Shirley, but just wait a moment. You've got to have the preamble before you get the mic. So,
and I want to say something about what Larry just said.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have a number of people who want to say things here. So the point about this is try and keep your questions short, and can I ask the team to keep their answers short? Because you have a set of international speakers here, and just one question could keep us occupied all afternoon. So if you can keep your answers well focused and keep your questions well focused, but they don't have to be questions, they can be observations because you've all had a lot of material. So we have an exciting 1 hour, 15 minutes if you need it, and Shirley is going to begin.
Thank you very much. Could I first of all thank all of you for the excellent presentations we've had? They're very, very stimulating, and I'm just trying to focus on one question which arises out of Larry's recent response. I understand what about having psychological immunity, and we've discussed that in our group, and I've discussed it with one or two of the speakers. But what I want to know is what I would call the group mind, what happens when a whole community, such as happened in Nazi Germany, gets hypnotized into something that is manifestly evil, but not to them. What can other people do about it to stop that? It's the same with ISIS on a smaller scale, where you've got a lot of people getting hooked on something, and what can be done to break that? I'll leave it at that.
Don't vote for Donald Trump. You know, I think there is a point in which evil should be resisted with the most forceful means possible, and I think we probably met that with response of the Nazis. But I think those examples are not usual, and that, you know, I think we can rely on metaphors here. I think Maria was right on target about the fact that the trajectory of history and psychology is toward love and compassion. And I think that's right. I mean, I think that light does banish shadows, to use another metaphor, and that we are obligated in every behavior in daily life to ask the question, does my behavior promote wellness and wholeness or not? I think if we all did that, then we would have much less ISIS out there to worry about.
And our light to the people opposing Mr. Trump.
There is stuff on the website somewhere. There are people who get, because of the fact that numbers are important here, and numbers have more power, together, you know, a lot of good energy. There are people who are doing anti-Donald Trump meditation sessions at certain times when there are rallies. I can't remember the name of the thing, but you might look it up. But I think that's a really good idea, to just join forces with other people who've got the same thing, and then they've got a big energy and everybody's wind each other up, and you can also create a big energy, because it's well known that the more people get together, the more impact they have on a negative environment.
I believe it's been organized by James Twyman.
Is it?
James Twyman,
then.
I'd just like to add something on protection here. And in the sort of Peter Dunoff teaching, he explains that you can surround yourself with light. It's one protective mechanism. But you can also describe a pentagram in the air. And that's something that I imagine that the belief about the efficacy of describing a pentagram above your head before you're going to sleep, for instance, would be important. But I also am reminded of linking this up. There's a man called T.C. Lethbridge, who some of you might have come across. He was a Cambridge archaeologist, and I remember reading in a book of his that at a subtle level, somebody had put some pentagrams up as protection, and the it was clear that the invisible beings with not such good intent were actually prevented from going past the pentagram. So I've no idea whether that's true or not, but I'm just offering it as another sort of a pentagram of light can maybe be a protective measure.
But David, is this a cultural thing? I mean, do pentagrams only work in Europe and not elsewhere?
I don't know.
Has there got to be a belief structure which supports it?
I think we're in uncharted territory here, or sort of very esoterically charted territory. In the pentagram is something that has obviously a history.
Yes.
And you know, maybe there's an energy to it, to that shape, in a way. You know?
Yes, as you say, it's uncharted
but I think the fundamental thing is light.
Yes. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, well, the point there, again, with the pentagram and the Lord's Prayer is that they've been used by so many people with such pure intent that gives them power. They've already got power because of the use, and so therefore if somebody else chooses to use the same thing that's already been given loads of power, it's going to have all that power already in it by use.
So we're into archetypes, really, aren't we? Right, John.
Yes, thank you. On the same theme of the psychological immune system, I like that very much. I think it's very true. A book I just reviewed, I hope it'll come out in the next network review, by Robert Whittaker. Probably Larry would know of the work of Robert. He's written two books. The Epidemic of Mental Disorders, which he attributes basically to psychiatric drugs, DSM. I like the comments of the panel. Thank you.
Do you want to reply to that? That's but really both Larry and Helen.
No, I have no response to that.
Well, I'm not sure, but about how it spreads. But definitely, it's quite obvious that we have a psychological immunity. It's complicated because we tend to be very reactive to anyone who has the same fundamental baseline negative pattern that we have internalized, possibly from imprinting from birth. So we react defensively to those people, and our natural defense system, our natural immune response to an invasion. So say we've got the example I used earlier was a feeling of worthlessness. So we've inherited a feeling of worthlessness, and that was going on in Germany at the time of the Nazis. They had massive feeling of worthlessness as a race. So say there's a feeling of worthlessness that you've got, and then somebody comes along from outside and stimulates that feeling of worthlessness, either because they have it themselves at some level, which usually most bullies and things have anyway, so the surface may be attacked, but the underneath is the worthlessness. So it starts to create a resonance with the negative energy. Now, because you're familiar with this and it's been damaging to you, your immune response goes into action. But the natural immune response to something that has harmed you in the past is anger and then hatred. If it's harmed you deeply, your response is going to be hatred. And this is an appropriate immune response. So I regard hatred as Custer's last stand, basically. It's like, destroy them before they destroy you. Okay, so the solution to that would be to see what somebody's negative behavior, let's say take Trump or whatever, although I think he's funny, but all the same, it doesn't really bother me because he's just hilarious. But the solution to a response for negative behavior is to see what it makes you feel that you don't like, that's not true of you. And so why are you hating that person or being angry with them if you don't want to admit to hatred? I'm quite happy about that. I think it's a very useful thing. I would like my body to be furious with something that's trying to kill me, like smallpox or something. And then undo that in yourself so that you change your pattern. So you eliminate the negativity that you've internalized by healing it, by replacing it with what your soul knows to be actually true of you. So you have to access the deepest negative thing that you're reacting to. Now, if you access that and you heal that thing, so you manage to get to the feeling that you have worth by knowing who you are and loving who you are, you know, for example, and then you move outwards towards the thing that's attacking you, you will offer healing to that thing. Now, the good thing about this is that when there's a mass negative, everything is resonating, okay. Now, if one person experiences that mass negative and heals it in themselves, their healing will naturally go out along the lines that connect with all the other people with the same negative. So you kind of naturally are tuned in to everybody with the same negative pattern, the same as we do when you meditate together, you tune into the light. So by changing your own pattern, you are sending out a force field, if you like, that will effectively change or offer the prospect of change to anybody else who has that pattern. So you can do a massive amount by working with yourself. If you let yourself remain fearful of the negative energy and back down, you will have hatred, so you will be contributing a negative energy. Even if you don't allow yourself to have the hatred, if you feel that it's injuring you, your body's going to do it anyway. So the most important thing is to eliminate your own fear and hatred, and then meet the negative thing that you think is injuring you with respect for yourself and your own truth, just total respect for yourself, and possibly the offer to them, you could respect yourself in the same way. Obviously, you're not trying to change them, you're trying to defend yourself, but in doing that for yourself, you may very well end up changing some of them.
Maya, do you have anything you want to say on that?
Well, mainly I agree completely with Helen's that it all starts with ourselves, and whatever bothers us tells something about ourselves. So whenever some person is doing something that annoys us, we can go inside and see if there's something similar inside of us, and then we can change that. And of course, because we're all connected through the collective consciousness, it influences the collective consciousness. And the more people heal themselves, the easier it becomes for the other people to heal themselves. So although maybe big things are happening in the world and it can give us a feeling of powerlessness, it does help just to start with yourself. And the other thing is, we cannot change other persons at will. I cannot say I'm going to change you. It's impossible. I can't change Isis, but I can change myself, and I can be conscious of my influence to everything else. And
so it's effectively morphic resonance, as Rupert Sheldrake would say. I can't resist putting it at this point. I don't know how many of you saw it, but there was a private eye with Trump on the front. And it said he was pointing at himself, and the caption underneath said, "Vote Trump, it's a no-brainer."
Okay, who's got the mic? Sorry, Larry.
Well, I don't know if this is relevant or not, but I was having a discussion once with Rupert Sheldrake, whom I know is a revered member of this organization, and we were talking about the use of mental imagery as a protective device, and Rupert said that people tend to get this wrong. He said, all over the United States, people surround themselves with white light as a protective image, and he said, from my point of view, the most intense form of white light is a nuclear explosion. Yeah. So Rupert said this may have unintended consequences. So I don't know how to interpret that. You know, you could say that the intention behind the image is this thing that matters, and it's not the literal image itself. So I've been confused by that for a long time. So I'll look to you to straighten me out on that.
Well, Larry, I think the answer to that is very clear, because everybody who goes into the light in their death experiences, they have an intense white light and it never burns their eyes, so it's clearly not a nuclear explosion. So
I feel so much better.
Who's got the mic?
Just two comments. I liked the two explanations of dealing with evil, and I think that contradicted your first suggestion, Helen, of joining the anti-Trump campaign, because we know that the more you resist, the more it persists, or it is Newton's law, you know, what you give out is what you get back. So you are actually reacting to him and therefore increasing his power. So we need to sort of send love to his opponents. And then coming on to the protection, Julian of Norwich, the anchoress, she used the cross and the Lord's Prayer to great effect when she was undergoing mental torture from her demons. And the pentagram is well known in sacred geometry, both in the East and the West. And it has links to Venus, the rose, and love, and cosmic forces.
Thank you. Any comments on that? Yeah.
I think I might have got this wrong about the Trump thing, because I didn't read it very carefully, but I think they're actually sending, making sure there's people going to the Trump rallies who are going to put good energy in, and we're supposed to support them. I mean, I don't do it, but it's just somebody's idea.
Yeah.
Well, about your comment that you get back what you put in, I think that there is a lot of truth to that. In my investigation of how negative prayers work, I came across the literature from the anthropological studies of Native Hawaiian Native shamans called kahunas. And there was a very strong tradition, highly researched by anthropologists in the 19th century, of what was called the death prayer. And this was a situation where kahunas would be hired by someone to curse someone to death at a distance. And this was never taken lightly, even by the kahunas themselves, because it was recognized that unless the kahuna doing this used specific protective measures, there was a boomerang effect, and the negative intentions would visit themselves on the person who was trying to perpetrate the death prayer. So at least in some anthropological traditions, I think there is affirmation for the truth of what you said.
There is a lot of information to prove that. Yeah, it's just the law of cause and effect. So whatever you send out is coming back in the same way. So if we focus on a negative, that will come back. That will be enforced. And in this case, if we don't want Trump, we know what we want instead. And we focus our attention on that. So it's all in line with the universal law. So never focus on what you don't want. I don't mean don't close your eyes. Close your eyes for it. But when you observe what you don't want, focus on what you do want. And the other thing I like to add, that in essence, we are all love. So also people who do things we don't like, even people who go to ISIS, they are in essence love, but something hurt them, something came in the way, and love is stronger than all the other energies. So love is the answer.
In fact, what goes around comes around was our film last night, really, wasn't it? Very clearly. Okay, who's got the mic?
this is really primarily for Larry and possibly for Barbie too. I wondered if you could just say something a bit more about your twin experiences and whether you found with your twin that the effect sort of attenuated as you grew older, or whether you got less sensitive to it.
Well, yes. My twin brother and I growing up had these telesomatic things going on all the time. We, would think each other's thoughts and interrupt each other to finish a sentence or start the sentence that he was thinking. We even showed up at a distance with bruises in the same place and, you know, with no explanation about how that sort of thing happened. This was not mysterious to us. It was just part of life. And so as we grew older, these interchanges pretty much stopped because we were so identical that we had difficulty as we matured in developing a sense of self. And this really caused us quite a bit of problems later on. Through grade school, high school, and even university, we graduated 1 and 2 in our class. And so there developed over the years this intense intellectual and academic competition. We went to medical school together. We had to take tests at the medical school entry level because the professor said twins never work in medical school. We don't accept twins. We pleaded with them. We had to take batteries of psychological tests to even get into medical school together, although our grades were superior. So they finally let us in, and the competition became so fierce between us that 6 weeks into the first year, my brother said, "I refuse to go through life competing with you like this, and I'm transferring to dental school." So he dropped out, confirming the suspicions of the entry committee. Twins just didn't work. And so he's practicing dentistry to this day. Actually, something else has happened. As we've gotten older, the telesomatic events have returned because on a spiritual, psychological level, we have become really close as we've gotten older. So it's as if we've sort of completed a circle where the telesomatic experiences of our youth, after a long hiatus, have begun to reappear again.
Barbie, do you want to say anything? Was Barbie over there? No, okay. One of the most interesting stories, which I think I've told some of you, we had a twin, one in England and one in Australia. He was a twin in our unit, and we were treating him for epilepsy. And he developed a pain in his in his heel bone. And when we x-rayed it, in fact, he had got TB, which is, first of all, at the stage that we were, it's rather unusual. And he then got a letter from his brother in Australia to say that he would be sad to hear that his twin had gone into hospital with TB in exactly the same place. So it's the same as your bone story, which is absolutely fascinating. And I think these linkages are enormously important. And, of course, it comes into my field with deathbed coincidences. And this is really, if you really want to go and see somebody desperately, your last chance to do it, you'll do it. And you, of course, will turn up and give them a message. Okay, who's got the mic? Right.
Hello. This could be a question for anyone in the panel. We've mentioned a few times in the last couple of days that the Western scientist worldview is still essentially materialist and perhaps hard determinist. My question is, to what extent do you think it's important or possible or desirable to try and bring your messages to these categories of people on their own terms and within the constraints of their scientific paradigm? Or is it a case of never the twain shall meet?
It's a really nice question.
Well, it's a question about how change happens. It's one of the things. And I was talking to Rupert Sheldrake this week, and one of the projects we're involved in I'm doing a feasibility study to see if we can do a survey of spiritual practices and beliefs among scientists and doctors. And because our hypothesis is that the incidence of these is actually far higher than is generally supposed, and because people are constrained sharing intimate and important experiences with others in case they're ridiculed, or they lose their reputation, or they lose their grant funding, or for all these sort of social reasons. And one of the other things that we were talking about is the fact that over the last 15 years or so, nucleated by network members, the Royal College of Psychiatry, Spirituality and Psychiatry Interest Group has emerged, the Consciousness and Transpersonal Psychology in the British Psychological society and the sort of conscious and experiential psychology, and then transpersonal psychology. These are two different sections. And so we were thinking that maybe we some members could help nucleate similar spirituality and groups within other professions. So, I mean, GPs would be an interesting example. Would it be possible within the Royal College of General Practitioners to help bring a group together of GPs interested in spirituality? One could think of engineers, and so there are other possible professional groups that I think, and I think the advantage of doing something like this is that then you're it's a much greater feeling of safety. You're with your peer group, and so you're all in the same boat in that sense. So you can, you know, get a sense of solidarity, and actually that was the reason the network was set up in the first place. So because people who are interested in psychical and mystical experience and who were qualified scientists and doctors, they could come and talk about these things, you know, within the scientific and medical network and feel they were able to talk and be more open. And that's what happens at our conferences. That's one of the reasons we do these conferences, is so that you can come together with people of similar mind and similar professions and outlook, and support each other. So that was an idea we were looking at this week, and I think it's quite likely this will go ahead with a proper polling company, and it'll be an important part, I think, of the work of the network going forward.
I did try a few years ago, just as a way of doing some of this. It's a perfectly good option. The drug companies host teaching sessions at hospitals, which they provide some food, and they leave their literature and stuff at the back, and they're not supposed to promote it. And so somebody gives a talk on something. It might be about a drug, but it hasn't got to be with the drug company. So I managed to get... I presented what I was going to present, which was quite a lot to do with the underlying emotional reasons for ill health, and also the spiritual thing about, you know, the more unified spiritual theory. And it got passed. You have to get it passed by the powers that be who allow these talks to be. It has to be done as further education. So the doctors go for the thing, get their lunch, get a bit of further education on their list, which they're supposed to have, or they can't maintain their membership to... whatever the membership is. And so I did these talks, and they were always full. And the interesting thing was that they told me that my talks were picked up really quickly by the drug companies, because they choose what talks they want. And I said, well, why do they choose mine? Because it's totally against their thing. And they said, the drug companies chose it because they thought people would come because it was different. And the thing was that actually a lot of people, I mean, some of them were not so... Well, you know, some of them just obviously they were just there to get their little thing, but still it's going to go in. But quite a lot of people, you know, said things to me, you know, or told me to read something, or somebody even gave me a book. About, I think the book was All Sickness is Homesickness, home being spiritual home. So, you know, it was not a hostile audience, although there was quite a lot of a bit of skeptic feedback, but. The most interesting one was that some guy said to me, you make it all sound so good, it can't be that good. And and so, you know, but that is a possibility. If somebody wanted to do that, I mean, the setup is there. These opportunities are really being wasted by being given to drug companies or things like that. And they want people to be doing it. So if anybody fancies going out and doing it, then there's the opportunity. I mean, it's a fairly simple setup.
Well, we're making progress. I have a long list of physicians who have contacted me over the years. Some actually have sent letters to me expressing their difficulty in bringing spirituality to the bedside 20, 30, 40 years ago. It was not uncommon then for doctors to be fired from the staff of a hospital if they were caught praying at the bedside of a patient. I have scores of letters like that. That would never happen anymore. And that's a sign that, you know, things are, in a sense, shifting. I think that there is a legacy, and the history of science, in particular medicine, that honor spirituality. The problem is that this has been scrubbed and sanitized from medical history. But if you look at certain books that examine this trend over the centuries, you can see that it has never died. Newton, for example, thought that his legacy would be secured by his interest in alchemy, not physics. You know, and that's been scrubbed from history. If you look at Ken Wilber's book, which I think David has mentioned earlier, Quantum Questions, the subtitle is The Mystical Writings of the World's Great Physicists. So many of them believe that consciousness was fundamental, that spiritual life was a reality. People like Planck, Schrodinger, even parts of Einstein's legacy, Sir Arthur Eddington, and so on. But that said, there is a cadre within science, there always has been, that is absolutely fundamentally opposed to what we're discussing at this conference. Even the greatest scientists have bumped into this. Max Planck, the father of quantum mechanics, was famous for saying, and this is a paraphrase, he said, science changes funeral by funeral. And what he meant by that is that there are many skeptics out there who will never come over to the new views, including our views, and they will simply die off. I mean, that sounds really morbid. And I hate to confess that it's come as a consolation to me from time to time, but we are going to win this war, and it is kind of a battle, let's face it, because of several reasons. First of all, the arc of history bends toward the truth. The cream does eventually rise, I think. And secondly, importantly, with respect to science, we have the evidence on our side, and that will eventually make a difference. There's hope.
I wanted to come back on that question of the medical. You'll have to do it through the microphone if you're going to come back.
So sorry to jump in.
I'll try and get it.
In the medical world, one of the things you're up against is the exam system, particularly at medical school level, but also now the specialist trainings, which go on for another 5 or 10 years after medical school, that if you try to bring something a little different, and what I've tried to bring at Imperial College is a Goethean way of observation and learning from phenomena rather than learning from your preconceptions, the main feedback you get specific, you know, rather than a score, but a specific feedback is, what's this got to do with my next exam? You know, what's it got to do with the, how can I use this in an exam? That's a problem, just to be aware of. That's all what I wanted to say.
This is a reflection on something which Larry was talking about before lunch, and an aspect of personality and taking the questioning back to one or two questions to what we were talking about before, slightly unrelated but close. You were saying, Larry, that you weren't particularly interested in whether any individuality of your own survived death. And my thinking about that is that it's not the person themselves who really values their own individuality. I just wonder what the people around you who love you would feel about that and about your losing your individuality after death, because it seems to me that it's the people that we love, whose individuality we appreciate and value most strongly. It's not the person themselves. And it reminds me of there was a very wise woman, I think her name was Irene Taylor, who years ago used to answer very abstruse questions on Radio 4. But once she was asked, how would you define love between partners, your love for your partner? And she said, I think it's real pleasure in watching the other person live. And that seemed to me to be very profound, because it's about their quiddity, it's about what makes them themselves, and it's about watching that process and getting very tenderly and sometimes passionately attached to that and valuing it, and nobody else could represent it, just that one person. So that's just what I wanted to throw in.
Well, I perhaps misspoke, but I don't think we lose all of our individuality and after our transition. I am really impressed by some of the eloquent descriptions of near-death that have been recently published, most vividly by Dr. Eben Alexander, who is a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon who left one of the most fantastic descriptions of the afterlife I've ever read. His account, I think, conforms to many near-death accounts of a complementary appreciation of individuality, personhood, as well as an overwhelming sense of oneness with everything there is. This does not seem logical. You know, we would say, well, it's one or the other. But apparently, most people don't experience it that way. It's a matter of both and instead of an either or. I meant to say earlier that I think some of the things that we attribute to personhood really are trivialities that don't deserve too much worry about, such as dress codes, the diet, the activity level, and all of that. I mean, I just think that's fairly trivial stuff. But the essence of personhood and who we are, I don't think disappears from the accounts I read.
Yeah.
Could I...
Yeah. Wait a moment. You'll have to use the microphone because nobody can hear you.
I just wonder, Nick, do you have a comment on this from your experience? No, you'll need a microphone.
If you're desperate, you can come up here and use it.
From the point of view of you losing personality, no, that remains. I've been, for anyone who doesn't know, I've been doing a lot of work with deceased military, getting them to move on when they've become blocked on the other side. But just a little anecdote from just this week relative to losing personality is that I'd been invited to go to Priscilla Castle. And they were explaining that the guy who'd built it in 1600 and something, died early 17-something, was very materialistic. And he'd had this mausoleum built and he wanted to be placed in there so that he could look over his estate when he passed on. And they opened up this mausoleum and found that there's body parts in there, so they had it closed up and brought the authorities in. And from that time on, they discovered that if they made derogatory comments about him, suddenly the picture on the wall went on a slant, or the clock flew off the wall and landed on the table. So I thought, now I understand why I've been brought here. I'd got to go and see this mausoleum. So I went up there, read the documentation on it, walked around it, and I'd been told that he had this built specifically so he could look out over his estate. So I went and stood out looking over this beautiful view of the Tamar, and suddenly I get, ooh, shiver. And I knew then that he had linked in with my body. So I just then continued to look out over the estate, because I'm working with the military. They had developed this ability to use my eyes to see what I was seeing. So to me, it was quite natural. And then I finished off looking around and wandered off. And as I was walking along, I thought, I wonder if he wants to move on. So I just thought, okay, are you ready to move on? This is all mine. Okay, well, you stay here then. So he had definitely got his personality and he'd been passed over for 300 years.
Okay. I'll just add something to that, if I may, because the question specifically related to relatives of the dying and the people who were left behind. And I think this is enormously important. I don't know if there's anybody here from the Exeter Group who've been working on a new thrust, which is dying healed. And that is really quite a different matter. And what it means is it means, in fact, not only going through your attic, but going through all your relationships and getting them right before you go. And if you do that, then the family will be much more in tune with your passing and won't tend to hold on to you and call you back. So I think there is quite another thrust now into dying, which is a much more open one than there was before.
Larry, you mentioned that
for medical degrees, students are required to know the importance of spirituality. I'm very curious. 75%, it seems, of American medical schools come into this situation. Now, I'm interested to know how that manifests. Is that an exam board entry requirement? Is that in any way playing lip service to political correctness? And secondly, how is there any form of measurement for this, or do they just accept the word of the applicant, or how is that established?
Several things come to mind. There are many methods that medical students are taught about how to take a medical history. This is a fairly sophisticated area. Many people have written about methods of inquiry, about how to assess spiritual health of patients. And this is a matter of exams that students pass before they are graduated. But this is serious stuff. I mean, this is not something that, you know, you just say, okay, I know how to do this and get by with it. This is testable, a testable ability that they have to meet. If you were to Google something called InSpirit, InSpirit, you would turn up a method of taking a spiritual history from a patient. That's only one example. That search would lead you to other methods of taking a spiritual history. And so, yes, it's fairly sophisticated stuff. And it's not religious, I must say. I mean, it goes deeper than what we would associate with religiosity.
You know, religious people or many people who claim to be spiritual aren't at all religious. I mean, it's, yeah, you made that point. Yeah.
Yep. Marilyn.
Marilyn Monk. I think I've nearly forgotten what I was going to say. I think I wanted to answer the question about how do we bring more spirituality and mysticism into science. And indeed, the reason I've been a member of the SMN for so long is that here I can be my mystic and my poet and my scientist. But where science has got something elegant to say about the subject under discussion, I don't, you know, we shouldn't ignore it. And I just wanted to make a comment, because we've mainly been talking about human mind and how it is part of one mind. And although Tom did introduce a sort of ladder of increasing complexity, and we talked about how love works, and obviously since love works, there's going to be a very strong evolution, selection in evolution for love. And I've often thought about that, and what I see as love is service. And looking at the ladder of increasing complexity, I don't think of top down or bottom up or middle out, but everything connected to everything else. I mean, if you change the activities of the atoms, you change everything. If you change the activity of the cosmos, you change everything. If you took something in the middle, like the life conglomerate and climate change, you change everything. So there's no top down, middle up. Everything's connected to everything else, and I think everybody agrees with that. But given that, what we observe is that everything is in service to a higher order structure. That's how evolution works. And in a way, that service is love. So you could, I mean, other people have said this before, and I'm always saying it. You could say the electrons are in service to the atom. They're in certain orbits. They have limited degrees of freedom. They know there's other electrons in other orbits, but they don't know about the atom. And I could go on, the atoms in service to the molecule to hold hands with other atoms. It sees other molecules of different shapes doing different things, but doesn't know about the cell. And we could go on, the cell's in service to the tissue, but it doesn't know what the tissue is. There are cells, similar cells doing similar things. The tissue to the organ to me, me to my society, my nation, my country, my religion, and then we get to the life conglomerate, that we're service to life, then the planet, and so on. Now, service is what makes all these different levels of order survive. So that you can take beehives, you can introduce one mutation into bees called the anarchic mutation, and if too many bees have the anarchic mutation, the whole beehive falls apart. If you have too many anarchists within a society or country, the thing falls apart. So service is absolutely essential for our survival. And service triggers pleasure centers in the brain. You know, the mother's service to the baby, or one's falling in love. Love and service is something that happens to you. It's not something you decide to do. And it happens to you because of oxytocin being released and endorphins and serotonins. So there's a lot of science that tells us how we work in service to higher order structures. And we know that it's very hard to understand the higher order structure. I mean, exactly what our service is about. But it's something that's very highly selected. That's the first thing I wanted to say. What was the other one? I mean, it was something to do about if we have one mind, and you could say we might be in service to that one mind. And I was very alarmed. I mean, I like to have an hypothesis to work on, at least. And for me, the hypothesis of the Big Bang and a sort of blueprint of Lego blocks, if you like, from which you have potential of all sorts of possibilities, depending on your particular assortment of Lego blocks, all occurring with certain probabilities in time. You could say there's a sort of cosmic blueprint. But if we don't even have a Big Bang to start with, I'm just wondering, I suppose my big question is, what is our hypothesis that we're working on? I've missed it. Is there a hypothesis about one mind and our being? I mean, I can see it as a sort of indistinct laser picture, hologram. You know, now we see through a glass darkly that I am connected to the whole. And in fact, the brain is really interesting because little bits of the brain can do the lot. The brain is like a hologram, if you know what I mean. So each of us sort of like a indistinct hologram picture or a bit of the brain knows everything, but very indistinctly. I'm looking for mechanisms, really, or hypothesis.
If you've got a hypothesis, Larry.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. Consciousness is non-local with respect to space and time.
What? Consciousness is not local?
Is non-local with respect to space and time. That's my hypothesis.
But non-local means that it's not existing in any identifiable region.
There are no boundaries, that's right.
Yeah?
No, it's not that it doesn't exist, it's that it is not confined to specific reasons.
Maybe it is.
They're not hearing you, Marilyn. We need a mic.
Yeah. Yeah. And non-locality has been proven several times. In 82, for the first time in French, and just recently last year in the Netherlands, and in between in Switzerland and different places. So it's a scientific fact that non-locality exists.
Yeah, I'm okay with non-locality. Okay. I don't know how it works.
She's okay with non-locality. She doesn't know how it works.
Well, join the community of physicists. I mean, we have a lot of fancy terms for non-locality, but they don't be fooled. They don't know how it works either. There's a lot of hand-waving about overlapping wave functions and that sort of thing. But to label something is not to explain it. Mm. What we have now are a bunch of labels for non-local events. But that's not to say that anyone so far truly understands how this works.
May I say something about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Like when we had this idea that the speed of light was the fastest, that was because we only looked on the levels of reality that were in time and space, and then that this is true. But as I explained, there's also this level beyond time and space, right. And this non-locality on quantum level takes place on this level. So if you can imagine that there is a way to get a message from A to B on the level beyond time and space, you can understand that there's no time necessary to get this message. So everywhere where this exists, this non-locality messages, the only conclusion we can say is that it happens on the levels of reality beyond time and space.
And
well, that is different because the here and now is on the edge between, like where I drew the river, between the levels of reality in time and space and the levels of reality beyond time and space.
Okay.
I have a question for Maria, that came up in our small group after your talk today. You talked about dynamic balance, the law of dynamic balance, and needing to write the balance with more of the feminine than just 50-50. And someone in the group asked the question, how do you do that? What do you mean by that? How would we write that balance? I wondered if you could say more about that.
Yes. If you try, well, maybe this should be. If you try to imagine.
Can yeah, you that's help? It.
You're there. It's okay. Oh,
you up. Need it up a bit.
Up, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. If you try to imagine the map I had here. So if we try to understand who we are a duality, whether we want it or not, because we are a part that exists on the levels of reality beyond time and space, which is our infinite part, and we are a part that exists, if we have a physical body, on the other side of the river in time and space. And those two aspects want to work together. And we can call the aspect that is on the side beyond time and space our higher self, or, well, there's many different other names to call it, but let's say that's our higher self. And we have what we can call our lower self. And to be able to function in an optimal way, it would be wise to have our higher self, who has the complete overview of everything, to make the decisions, what we will do in a certain occasion. And then have our lower self, who knows everything about linear order and what to do first and what to do next, to be an aspect of ourselves who will do the practical work. And if that is possible, we can function in an optimal way. And so in accordance with calling some of us masculine and other part of us feminine, this higher self is in many traditions called our feminine side. So our feminine side, what is the infinite part of ourselves, knows the big picture. And if that part of us takes the decisions, and our lower self, what we can call our masculine self, who what is good in doing the practical things, being the person who is doing it, then we are in this balance that we can function in an optimal way. But what is the big problem? If we get in a situation of fear, of pain, that we don't want to confront with, this lower self of us tends to get the idea that it doesn't want to listen to the higher self anymore, because the higher self wants us to heal ourselves. But the lower selves know this is too frightening, too painful, I don't want to look at it. And as a result of that, the lower self doesn't want to listen to the higher self anymore and want to be boss itself. And that's what we call ego. Yep.
And that's it. That's exactly what parallel to what Ian McGilchrist is saying, by saying that the right hemisphere is the master hemisphere, the right hemisphere is the intuitive, creative, holistic hemisphere, and the other one's gone off on its own, the left hemisphere's gone off on its own and thinks it's self-sufficient, and that's where the trouble arises.
Okay. Okay.
I wanted to mention something.
Can you hold the mic closer?
Right. About consciousness remaining after we're dead. And this gentleman was talking about these rather strange beings that were doing all sorts of things, whatever. I think it's sort of, in my experience as a healer, where we aim our arrow is what we receive back, which is what we're all talking about. So often in my work, a deceased relative of someone would come into the room, but they were always very benevolent, because the most important thing was the love and the healing of that moment. So I think during our own evolution, if we have fear inside us, we tend to see the fearful aspects of what is there on the other side. Does that contribute in any way?
Let me just add then that I wasn't suggesting that there was any fear. It was that he had a materialistic aspect to his personality and he didn't want to leave that domain. But to come back to the question that I obviously didn't pick up on, Peter, about the state of relatives, I think if they are aware that the one who passed over is in a good place, then they should not be hanging on to that aspect of their relationship. And in one case, there was a lady came to us and she said that her godfather had been in a coma for about 2 weeks and she felt that he needed to move on and she didn't know what to do about it. So I just suggested to her that just sit at the side of him, take his hand, you don't have to say anything, just think, if you want to leave, you can leave. And she came back the next day and she said, I did that last night, and he left within 10 minutes. So it's the person who's left behind who, in many cases, they're hanging on to those who passed over.
Thank you very much. I think that's an enormously important observation. But it goes with knowing that your relatives are in a safe place. And in dying healed, one of the things you will learn about is the comments that the dying make just before they die, and the comments the dying make when they come back in the deathbed coincidences. And all of those always indicate that they're in a really safe place. So you've got to do the work which you're suggesting beforehand. Thank you.
Just a couple of brief thoughts. I'm a layman, but so I tend to have these slightly lateral, off-the-wall thoughts, and I bow to all your great knowledge. The first one actually came very recently from Maya, when you talked about duality, and I suddenly thought, Trinity. It's an interesting thought, because you talked about the three different bodies, the material body...
Can you
subtle,
put the mic closer?
Sorry, the subtle body and the higher body. That's a Trinity.
Yes.
Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, you could correlate it. It's an interesting thought. The second one was about non-return vows, and I wondered what you thought of the concept about protection, where possibly there is a non-return system. In other words, if it's top-down and we're reaching to the highest, maybe there is a sort of non-return valve, so that we can go upwards in our consciousness and our projection, but maybe negativity hits a level where there is a non-return valve. That was just, I wondered what you thought about that. And secondly, and perhaps most radically, as there are these three bodies, and we are in the material where there is trouble, do you think it's conceivable that we will leave the material altogether and migrate into the subtle? And because when I was thinking about the problems of the world and rape in many places, the violation of the masculine and the feminine, I thought, well, what is the way out of this? And I thought, well, most of the trouble is that we are in physical bodies.
Are those three questions all to me? I was not able to keep on all your three questions, so... Okay, I first have to confess that I do not know much about the Bible, so that's, I just leave that. And the second thing, yes, I said we have three bodies, and I said this because we all here, I assumed, are most familiar with the situation of being in the stronghold. But once we are in balance at the river, we experience our physical and our energy body as a coherent unity. So from there we can say we are a duality of the parts of ourselves that are in time and space and the part of ourselves that is beyond time and space. So this is just a matter of how we want to define this. And help me, what was the other question?
Do you think there'll come a stage
dimensions.
Okay, so this is a huge question, because the question that goes before this is, why are we on Earth? What is the purpose of being here? And I mean, on Earth, what is the purpose of being a spiritual entity coming into a physical body? Well, the shortest answer there is because we want to learn. We want to learn how it is to be confined in a physical body and still being this infinite potentiality. So what we try, this is my idea, we try once while being in a physical body to become who we are in essence, like what I taught with the first law. And that is the big project of learning. And most of us don't learn that in one physical life. So then comes in the reincarnation idea, that our infinite part, after we die, we have a kind of evolution of, a evaluation of what we did in this life. And there are conclusions about, okay, this is what we learned, and that this is what we still have to learn if we want to reach this purpose. And we make another plan to come back to learn more. And so we can say, if we have learned everything there is to learn by being in a physical body and embodying who we really are in essence, we have passed our exam, and we have no need to come back into a physical body again. And some people say, for example, the entity who came to Earth as Jesus was such a person, and now this entity has no need to come back in a physical body again. So that could be a part of your answer. Yeah.
Thanks very much. We have time for one more short question. You've got the microphone, go.
Which is not quite a question. It's more a sort of suggestion or a hypothesis of how to find our way around.
That's nice.
In time and space. So I'm taking us back now to time, to the time and space part of the universal laws. And I think it includes actually most of the universal laws, the rhythms and the causality, and what else did we have? I'm not sure about correspondence, but vibration certainly. One of the Mystics and Scientists conferences was on complexity back in the 1990s, and Ralph Abraham contributed a marvelous talk, and he had published previously a book or a collection of essays on morphodynamics. And so what I want to talk about is morphodynamics in Ralph Abraham's sense. It's not quite the same as morphic resonance, I don't think, of his friend Rupert Sheldrake, but morphodynamics. I think morphodynamics is an excellent way to negotiate time and space. And a specific example, Maya, from your talk is the number of spirals you put up, a snail shell, a vortex down a sink or bath plug, and a sunflower seed. They're all vortices, but they all have different morphodynamics. So to really comprehend them more deeply, you'd have to think of how did they come about. Also the Fibonacci series, where you actually have the golden ratio in the spiral. That came back out about through a mathematical or proportional process. But the plant is another morphodynamics. The sink is another morphodynamics. The snail shell is quite another morphodynamics on a much longer time scale. The cosmos is another morphodynamics on a much bigger and longer time scale. So I think really to comprehend them, you've got to learn to think morphodynamically. And I think this really allows you to navigate your way through most of those time and space universal laws. And that's what I wanted to say, that to try and suggest that. So it's kind of fluid thinking. So think appropriately about your river. You have to think fluidly.
Yes, and exactly what you are describing now, I do describe in my book too, but there was not any space or time left here to say something about it. But I agree completely with what you said, and we can call this fractals. Fractals are the same kind of patterns.
The thing about fractals is in organic systems, the different scales are not self-similar. They're simply not. On smaller scales, you have different morphodynamics from larger scales because different physical laws are operating on the quantum scale, on the cell scale. On the cell scale, for example, there's surface tension and diffusion happening, which is negligible on our macroscopic scale. On the macroscopic scale, there's momentum change and there's gravity. And on the biggest scale, there's gravity and relativity.
Yes.
So quite different morphodynamics. So it's not fractal. It's not self-similar.
Okay.
It's multi-scale, but not fractal.
Well, we of course, we can disagree about this, but I feel at this moment, because the subject is quite complicated, I feel my English is getting... not enough, sufficient at this moment, just... to explain my vision at you, but just read it in my book, and then I guess you will find out that there is not that much disagreement about the two of us.
We have it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, with that, I'm afraid we'll have to end. It's always my pleasure at this time in the conference to thank David very much indeed, because there isn't a chance for anybody else to thank him. So what I would like you all to do is to thank David for his contribution and everything he's done. And now, David, I'll hand over to you to close the conference.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter. Well, I'm going to just make some thanks before just a few concluding remarks. First of all, to thank the speakers for their wonderful talks, taking so much trouble, coming such a long way. And Barbie, too, thank you for coming and supporting us. Really, I think the way that the talks have fitted together, whether it's a fractal or morphodynamics, I'm not quite sure, has been quite remarkable. So I'd like you to join me in thanking the speakers very, very much indeed. Then I'd like to thank various network colleagues who've helped over the weekend. Paul has been an enormous support for the conference. Richard Irwin, who's done all the computing side of things. Then we have Martin, our irreplaceable man on the sound. And we have our helpers, Michelle and Marilyn, who've been doing sterling work at the gate. And we also have Chiara and Rodrigo, who've been coordinating things in the office. And, you know, without all this help, these conferences just, you know, can't happen and can't run smoothly. So... it's enormously important. It's a collaborative effort, and I hope I haven't missed anybody out there. But that, so those are the thanks, and thank you also for coming. So I just want to add a few kind of concluding remarks on the theme. We've been talking about non-locality and the universal mind and why it matters, which was also part of your title, Larry. And I think if you don't now... realize why it matters, you probably haven't been paying attention over the weekend. And of course, paying attention has been one of the important messages that we've all been articulating. The implications, as I think we've all tried to explain, are enormously significant. And the corollary of that is that the more people who realize this around the planet, the more coherent our lives and our societies will become. If we understand this perspective, we understand its implications in terms of law, in terms of order, in terms of context, in terms of metaphysics. And something that I've taken also from the weekend is this articulation of relationality, that the oneness implies relationality, this intrinsic relationality, this deep relationality that Tom was talking about. And then metaphysically also, the expression of our soul truth, which Helen has been referring to, or just more recently somebody used the expression of essence, manifesting our essence. You know, you were talking about that through our lives. And I think we all understand what that means. And we're all trying our best is one way of putting it. But then the other metaphor that's come out is actually unblocking, getting out of the way. And so every metaphor has its limitation. So, effort and trying is important in some context. And then in other contexts, it's surrender. It's getting out of the way. It's allowing things to flow through. And we all know that the blockages or the stuffing that's got in the keyhole, there are all sorts of ways of, there are all sorts of different images that have come up. And so I suppose one of the skills is to know when we actually need to make some effort and when we need to surrender, when we need to be active, when we need to be receptive, because these are the polarities that they form the dynamics of our lives. So this is a kind of sensitivity that we need to develop so that we are managing to have the right operating system in the right circumstances. And then I think I was also struck by your image of the opening virgin, the Vierge, like this inclusiveness and the need to shift our emphasis more towards the feminine. We're staying with Anne Baring tonight, so I'm going to ask her about the opening virgin and see whether she knows about this. I'm pretty sure she will. And then I think my last remark comes back to what you were saying, Larry, about Aldous Huxley, this embarrassing finding that after 45 years of research and study, the best advice he could give people was to be kinder to each other. And so there's been a leitmotif of kindness and of love in its widest sense running through our reflections and what we can take away. And I've also been struck myself, because I've been attending these conferences since 1981, where I've only missed one year. And I've been struck by the beautiful atmosphere that we have created together. And that I think, is part of what Peter would call network magic, it's important to be learning together, but it's also important to be caring for each other. And so if a network can be a place where we can learn and care for each other, then I think we will be manifesting the ideals of our founders. And it's been a particular pleasure also to have Jenny Blaker here with Neil. Jenny is the daughter of George Blaker, who's the principal founding father of the network. And I hope, Jenny, you've been encouraged by your experience over the weekend. And I can feel that George would have enjoyed being here too. In fact, he probably is. So can I just close on that note and ask the speakers to help me blow the candle out and send the light out into the world. So we all need to take part in this. This is a participatory event. So. Okay.
You've got the best place.
Well, okay, we'll be right there. One, two, three.
We could do it.
There we go.